This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein in our Fargo studio, joined by my co-host, Ashley Thornburg.
Hello.
Ashley, how are you?
I'm great. How are you, Craig?
It's election day for those of us who live in North Dakota. We want to remind everybody to get out and vote.
Lots of people doing their due diligence and being good citizens, and I'm glad to hear it.
We hope the turnout is large. Ashley, in the second half of today's show, we'll delve into an initiative aiming to make North Dakota the healthiest state in the nation. Joining us is Wayne Salter. He's the Commissioner of Health and Human Services, which is the largest organization within our state government. And he is introducing what's really a pioneering business plan focusing on physical health, mental health, and accountability. However, today, you'll be discussing emotional health and community well-being.
You know the show The Moth, right?
Sure.
This live storytelling show that's on public radio. Well, it inspired Laura Talbot to create The Tell in Fargo. And after a four-year hiatus here, part COVID, part Laura moving, it is back. And the first new show is this Thursday at Cellar 624 in Fargo. And the doors open at 6:30. And we share now a lovely conversation with you on the power of storytelling and building connection with Lori Baker and Stacy Nicholson, two ladies helping bring back The Tell. Stacy, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Lori, thank you so much for joining us today.
We are so happy to be here.
Happy is a lovely word to use for an event like this. Let's talk about the power of live storytelling. What is it? Because the two of you have very different natural personalities in a way that really complement each other, but in a way that live storytelling is invigorating for one and terrifying for the other. We'll start with the invigorating one. Lori, what do you love about live storytelling events?
That is a funny question, because the live storytelling event part is also terrifying to me.
Okay.
Because I like a script.
Ah.
You know, I like, grew up in doing communications, and I always made scripts. And so my draw to telling stories at The Tell was, I want to learn how to just stand up and talk and trust that what comes out will be interesting, amusing, sad, whatever, but it will be something and it will be whole. And it's been a very good teacher in that way. What I like about listening to live storytelling events is the unbelievable and complete range of human emotion that gets displayed.
Hmm. Stacy, I've had the privilege of knowing you for many years. You're married to a colleague of mine here at Prairie Public, and consistently the kind of person who every time I was with you, I was like, girl, why don't you have a podcast? Like, like you are a brilliant storyteller, and yet you were incredibly hesitant to get up on stage at The Tell. And I remember distinctly the first time that I saw you live on stage, you were playing with your skirt the whole time. And I don't mean to expose you here, but you were very not comfortable on stage. And yet the story was delightful. Talk about the whatever it was that made you not want to go on stage, and then how you got there.
I'd been going to The Tell for years before I finally put my name in the hat. And one of the reasons that I did finally put my name in the hat, well, there are a couple. Laura, the founder of The Tell, made it such a safe place that after years of looking at other people tell stories, and there was, you know, no heckling. It was just a safe place to be vulnerable, be yourself. There wasn't going to be any repercussions from it. It was just going to be good. So I thought, maybe I could do this. The other reason that I kind of wanted to tell a story was because I go to funerals. I love Reader's Digest, and there was a story in Reader's Digest that said, always go to the funerals. Mm. And it was written by a young man who went to his teacher's funeral, and it just changed his life. And yeah. After that, he just always went to funerals. So I try to always go to funerals. And when I go to funerals, there's usually a time to tell a story. And I usually have a story, but I had never told one.
Oh, wow.
And because I knew I'm a crier, and yeah. I'm going to get up there and I'm going to be crying.
Right now.
I'm getting I'm going to cry more than the widow. I'm going to cry more than the kids. People are going to wonder, who is that? And somebody's going to say, well, I think she was a neighbor 20 years ago. And I would always feel ridiculous. So I never told the story. And I also never left a funeral without regret because I didn't tell a story. So finally, after Laura and the tell had created what felt like a very safe space, I thought, I'm going to tell a story. So I told my very first story, and that's the very first one that you saw me tell, and I was terrified. I thought, I'm going to throw up, I'm going to pass out, I'm definitely going to cry. But I made it through without doing any of those things, and then I won. And that brought a whole new terror, because then I had 5 months to dread being in the tell-off in April. And I can tell you, I prayed many times for an appendicitis during that 5 months. I thought, there's got to be something that can get me out of this. But I survived that too. And I went on to tell in other seasons and win and have to suffer the dreaded tell off. But it is such a good experience. And after that first time that I told, I had such an adrenaline rush. I didn't sleep all night. I felt like a rock star, which in my life I have never really felt like I've accomplished a whole lot of extra special things. But yeah, so that was my first tell experience, and it was great.
Yeah, well, I'm so glad that you get to feel the way that you make other people feel when they're in a circle with you.
Thank you.
And now she tells stories at funerals. She told one on Saturday, and it had everybody just in stitches and tears at the same time, which is kind of the Stacy specialty.
Yeah,
in my view.
The full range of human emotion. I'm really intrigued by three words that both of you have said. Lori, you said trust, that you could get up and say something and trust how it would land. And Stacy, you said safe place and vulnerability. These feeling states that are like stabbing a cloud. It's a nebulous thing to attain, but when it happens, you can feel it. Lori, I want you to explain a little bit more what you mean when you said that I could trust that what I said was gonna, and I don't remember already what you said, was gonna land, was gonna matter, that you're gonna matter.
I'm so used to my whole career has been doing work for other people, being in a play where I wasn't being myself, writing things for paper or broadcast that weren't for they were someone else's story. I never told my own stories, or if I did, it was only in my therapist's office and to trusted friends who probably heard the same story 7 times. And so the trust was, Stacy's 100% right about the creation of the tell as a safe space, which is not what you would naturally think of when you're thinking of a live storytelling event, but I used it as a vehicle to trust myself, maybe in a little bit different way than Stacy did, but fundamentally I'm reaching for the same thing. My stories matter. My ability to do other people's stuff needs to be taken seriously by me. So it is a matter of having a safe space and then trusting myself, which has been, it's one of those issues that takes you to therapy.
That's Lori Baker. Also joining us today is Stacy Nicholson. They are two members of an ad hoc committee bringing the tell back to Fargo. This is a live storytelling event that happened for many years, inspired by The Moth, which you can hear right here on Prairie Public. And it disappeared for a bit when the founder moved away. That's kind of how things like this go. Back for events Thursday, June 13th, again July 11th and August 1st. And the themes, Starting Over, Revolution, Come Together. So we've got a little John Lennon and Beatles love going on here. Stacey, talk a little bit about the music and how having these themes kind of sets the tone for what you're going for.
The themes are really helpful as to me as a storyteller because it will help me to make something a little more cohesive. The mm-hmm. The tell-offs were always a challenge for me because there was no theme and there was no direction. But if I have a theme, I can make just about any story fit a theme if I want to, because I think a good story has elements of just about everything in it. So I could tell the same story just about any month if I wanted to. It might not be good, but I could make it fit a theme.
Well, you know, it's really fascinating. I remember a conversation once with a retired English professor talking about writing a haiku every day and how she found it actually to be very freeing to have the constraint of the form to work with instead of, you know, theoretically writing an epic poem should be more freeing. But you had to think about something in a little bit different way. Does that feel like sort of similar?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. When the sky's the limit, it's hard to narrow it down. But once I, you know, if I have something to focus on, it makes it a lot easier for me. Other people probably could do things a lot differently. And the music is a nice break between the storytellers. The music is an event of itself, actually. It's not just secondary to the storytellers. We have great musicians lined up. Yeah. Laura always had great musicians at the original tell, and we're bringing some of those back. Warren Christensen and Darren Wentz will be returning. And
Gordy Bridgeford, also apparently affectionately known as Wild Thing. I'm excited to hear him. He's quite the character, and it's going to be really fun. And I wanted to add a note, too, that, you know, Starting Over was kind of a natural theme for now because, really, the tell did continue a little bit after its original founder left. It was COVID that killed it.
Gotcha.
And we had tossed around so many ideas, you know, kind of, I'm thinking life in a post-COVID world or after the zombie apocalypse. I don't know. But we are starting over with the tell, hoping to attract a wide and excited audience.
Yeah.
And in a really fun space. I don't know if you've been in Cellar 624 or not, but used to be the VIP room. The redo is gorgeous, and it's just really it's going to be fun. And it's also accessible, which was very important to us. It was important to us all along. And so when we have this opportunity, we wanted to make sure that was nobody could be excluded because they had a mobility issue or something like that. So.
And how it works day of is people show up, they put their names in the hat if they're willing to get up and tell a story. From there, you have to actually draw the name. So it's not a guarantee that you'll get up on stage, right?
Correct.
Okay. Now, I noticed, too, that both of you are members of the Unitarian Universalist Church of Fargo-Moorhead, and that's one of the fiscal sponsors here. That church, I've only been a couple of times, but it seems to me that it is communion and fellowship that is very much based around the idea of sort of honoring someone's innate humanity regardless of a faith background. How does that play into an event like the tell?
Well, actually, there were so many Unitarian Universalists that were coming to the tell that we started having a storytelling service at church occasionally. You know,
which we still do.
Yeah. So, you know, it was very popular. I always joke if you give a Unitarian a microphone, you're never going to get it back.
Your allusion to, you know, what we believe is very right on. Our first principle is to affirm the inherent worth and dignity of every person. And that is kind of foundational to the TEL. Mm-hmm. But all our principals seem to play a role in there somehow.
The inherent worth and dignity of all people.
Of all people, mm-hmm. Yeah. And the respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. Mm-hmm. I love that one because I find a lot of the stories are really really be connected to, you know, how we exist in this world of many beings. Yeah. And how they play a part in who we are, who we become, who we were. It was pretty serendipitous, though, that it was all you use. And in fact, everybody on our committee, on our ad hoc committee, either is or has been a Unitarian Universalist. So we're also organizers. We love a little activism.
What do you mean by activism? And maybe let's keep it specific to storytelling.
You know, Fargo-Moorhead as a community has such a vibrant and broad arts culture. But the thing that has been missing since COVID killed the TEL was live storytelling. Mm. It's not the same as being a comedian. It's not the same as a theatrical production or anything like that. It's completely grassroots, which is fundamental to activism. It's completely empowerment, in a sense, human empowerment, and it tells us so much about ourselves and gives people a chance to express in a way that nothing else does. And people stand up there and they tell family stories that they have not yet told their families, which is probably... Well, I mean, I was one of the people that did that. You know, I talked about caring for my dying mother. And thank God she never heard it because it was pretty honest about the ups and downs of that experience. I did a family stories class once through NDSU, and she was one of the people I interviewed. And I heard stories in that experience, that very structured experience, that she never told before and she never told after. So you put people in this environment and really different and important things happen as far as what they share of themselves and their reality.
Is it fair to say that some of that is the space and not just the safe space that you have created by being non-judgmental and being open, but just the actual physical space of you've got the lights on you, you can't see anybody. You know, sometimes looking someone in the eye, it's harder to talk to them one-on-one. In some cases, it's sort of easier to be on stage, at least for me, I can't see the other people judging me, and so I'm way more open, even on a microphone, than I would be one-on-one.
I think we're finding that true at this moment.
Yes, I totally agree. I need to have the lights in my face. There was, you know, a venue maybe that we
the TEL was at
previously, and the light wasn't adequate, and I just lose my place and freeze up and not, you know, if I made eye contact with somebody in the middle of a sentence, I just froze a little bit. So the lights are very important.
I'm much more about the platform and the stage, the front of the room phenomenon, because I've done a lot of teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't need the light. I don't even really need the microphone, although I love it. but it, front of the room and you're all sitting out there, I am going to perform for you.
Lori Baker and Stacy Nicholson, ad hoc committee members organizing the TEL. The TEL returns to Fargo-Moorhead with its first event Thursday, June 13th at Cellar 624 in Fargo. Doors at 6:30. The event starts at 7. Entry is $15, cash only. And there are events again on July 11th and August 1st, and more events announced through November. So follow the the Tell on social media with a big year-end tell-off, which features the winners of each monthly Tell event, and that is coming up on December 12th. Lori, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having us.
Stacy, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Ashley.
Support for Pray Public is provided by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well at all ages.
Welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. In this Plainspoke essay, Tom Eason reflects on the fluidity of regional borders, emphasizing that the Midwest and the Great Plains can coexist within the same space due to shared cultural and physical characteristics.
Coming home from the Midwestern History Conference, changing trains in Chicago, laying over a few hours at a fourth floor table in the downtown Harold Washington Library, writing this essay. I'm quite certain I am in the Midwest. Dawn tomorrow morning, I'll ride the Empire Builder into the Red River Valley at a light in Fargo. At that point, I will be equally certain I am in the Great Plains. If I were to ask the first citizen I met whether we were in the Midwest, however, the person probably would say yes, and I would not say this is mistaken. For regions, however much people like to map them, do not have borders. It is quite possible to be in both the Midwest and the Great Plains at the same time, also in the Norwegian settlement region and in the Bison Fan region, all at the same time. People who obsess about borders probably did not do well at math in high school. They confuse parameters with perimeters. Perimeters, those are geometric. They have edges. Parameters, they are common elements. They define things from the center, according to commonalities. So what are the parameters of the Great Plains? Well, listen to 100 or so of these radio essays and you may get a fair idea. Or you can start with Walter Prescott Webb and say, level, treeless, subhuman. These are all physical commonalities. Add in some cultural stuff like, ethnic stock and land use, but you're still not getting to the heart of it. These things are common conditions, but the distilled commonalities that define the Great Plains are stories, narrative invested in the land. Webb wrote his book, The Great Plains, in 1931 as a self-conscious effort to invest the level land with narrative. The same goes for Plains Folk on Prairie Public every week. My friends at the Midwestern History Conference say the Midwest has been neglected in history, which is to say, it lacks defining narrative. This they hope to supply. Their defining work is harder than that of the Great Plains historians. The Great Plains, all along, have been defined by their commonalities. The Midwest has taken shape by virtue of being surrounded by other regions. Its historians have to figure out what it means to be in the middle and what stories to tell. We know enough to say there are some important differences in our parameters. The Midwest has greater urban centers and urban institutions, such as this fine Chicago Public Library in which I sit. Often the Midwest and the Great Plains are at loggerheads over politics. Blue and red, people like to say these days, but even when they are pursuing similar aims, they do it differently. It's the difference between, say, the Nonpartisan League of the Prairies and the progressivism of the Midwest. The Midwest and the Great Plains are fated to confront one another over matters of center and periphery. Some things just tilt east. Plains folk resent the slights and profits of urban Midwesterners. Hey, who among us on the plains didn't cheer when Tyler Roll ran roughshod through the Gopher secondary? We have similar conflicts within the Flickertail State, probably always will. It is so easy to typify the Fargo crowd as a bunch of Twinkies and lake people and mall walkers. There is that famous passage from Webb that begins, "The Easterner, with his background of forest and farm, could not always understand the man of the cattle kingdom." and it goes on to invoke the law of a six shooter on the hip. But we are so much more civilized now.
Dr. Tom Ezern is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University. Coming up after this break, North Dakota's goal to be the healthiest state in the country. That's after this.
Welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Today we're joined by Wayne Salter. He has recently taken on the role of North Dakota's Commissioner of Health and Human Services. Despite being in the position for just a few months, Salter, known for his business acumen, has ambitious plans for the state's largest agency. Commissioner Salter, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you.
You were appointed as the Executive Director of the Department of Health and Human Services just this past January. You have come here from Texas via Florida or Florida via Texas. What brought you to North Dakota?
Well, you know, I'm known for doing some unorthodox things, and I think this is one of those things of really continuing my career of making a difference in the lives of individuals. North Dakota had a commissioner's opening. It was a larger scope of responsibility, but it really fit within my journey and my passion to serve individuals.
Give us a little history of your background relative to business practices of large organizations and governmental organizations. Is that your specialty?
Absolutely. You know, I started in government back in 1997 with the Florida Department of Children and Families. I'll date myself. I walked into the organization as a food stamp cashier, and we were much like bank tellers. It was our role to count millions of dollars of food coupons, mail them out to food recipients. I stayed with the Florida Department of Children and Families for over 17 years. I served in key roles, including the statewide call center director. I had call centers in three locations, Miami, Tampa, and Jacksonville, over 600 employees. I served as the Bureau Chief of Policy. I also served as the Deputy Director and as the Interim Director. In 2014, I answered the call to go to the great state of Texas. They were looking to do some business process redesign, and that's something that I'd been very instrumental in doing in the state of Florida. We had done it several times, and they were looking for a director of innovation. And so I originally was interested in doing that, but they reached out and said, we need an associate commissioner for operations. And my first response was absolutely not. It was about 10,000 staff. I was looking to lessen my workload, and this was essentially increasing it. But I flew out to Texas, had some conversations. You know, I looked at their business model, and I said, wow, this is an opportunity to innovate. I went to Texas in 2014 as the Associate Commissioner for the Office of Social Services. In 2017, Texas was directed by the state legislature to merge five agencies into one. And at that time, I was appointed as the Deputy Executive Commissioner of Access and Eligibility Services. I still maintain approximately 10,000 staff, and I did that for approximately 7 years. And then it was time for another change. And so, you know, answered the call to come to North Dakota, again, to continue the journey of helping people be the best version of who they could be.
If you were to summarize for me the governor and the cabinet's marching orders for you relative to the Department of Health, what would you say?
Absolutely. It was apparent out the gate that their mindset was serving people, and they wanted a leader, A, who could motivate the agency to move forward, a leader who definitely had a heart and a passion for serving, and a leader who wasn't afraid to take risks in care and concern for the people.
Let's get into some of the nuts and bolts of what you've already started to do. Let's talk Medicaid renewal work that your office has done. You've completed now a 13-month federal initiative to determine eligibility for folks who coverage was temporarily extended because of COVID, but then needed to do some work to continue their coverage. What was in that process?
Oh, absolutely. This was an unprecedented event for our agency. We, within a 13-month period of time, had to renew the eligibility of over 134,000 individuals. And what that means is that meant our Medicaid workload increased by 50%. Not only did the Medicaid workload increase by 50%, but we also had to maintain, you know, processing for other programs such as SNAP and TANF. I will say that it had a direct impact on programs such as SNAP. You know, shortly after my appointment in January, we received a letter from USDA FNS saying that our processing timeliness for SNAP was unacceptable. And honestly, it was. It was at 55%, which means that we were processing only 55% of all SNAP applications and renewals timely. The federal time standard is 95%. You know, being new to the state, I reached out to our zone partners and we had a meeting. I will be transparent. It was a very frank meeting, but we left that meeting with the understanding and with the agreement that this is unacceptable and we all have to do better by North Dakotans. And you know, if you will, you know, being up in farm country, we put our hands to the plow and we implemented some very aggressive strategies to really do that, to do better by North Dakotans. And in a 3-month period of time, if you look from March to June, we processed through those enhanced strategies an additional 38,000 applications and renewals. And that really is the power of when partnership comes into play, when we get out of the way and really let the essence of partnership come forward, you know, great things can happen. You know, I was proud to announce, you know, the other day that we are now at 93% timeliness, and that is absolutely phenomenal. To go from 55% in January to 93% as of today, kudos to our state team, kudos to the zone directors. They did a phenomenal job. I even had an opportunity to meet with all of the eligibility workers who work in the zone. You know, and I really share it with them. Like, we are responsible for the lives of people, and they depend on us. It was a rallying cry. And I tell you, those individuals stepped up to the plate, and that 93% is indicative of the work that they have done.
Are there still people out there who lost Medicaid coverage post-COVID that you need to reach?
You know, part of it is on the onus of the recipient. We reached out to everyone who was on our Medicaid rolls. And so, of course, we had individuals who responded and individuals who did not respond. But we have done due diligence in notifying them of the requirement. For the ones who lost coverage, you know, all is not lost. We actually automatically refer them to the federal marketplace to look at some Medicaid subsidies. So we do think over the next period of 3 to 4 months, we will have some individuals who will churn back in. You know, it's been 4 years that we've been sustaining coverage. You know, we've been saying we're going to start the renewal process. We had to get official notification from CMS. And that kind of, you know, comes like junk mail eventually. You know, you don't really check it. You don't really pay attention to it until you go to use it and it's not there. But thankfully, you know, if that occurs, you know, being that we are moving our timeliness needle, we shouldn't have an issue with restarting anybody's coverage. And the beautiful thing about Medicaid, we can retroact coverage for 3 months. So if someone experienced a gap because they did not respond and they come back and they have medical bills, as long as they provide verification of those bills, we can go back 3 months and make sure that they're made whole.
Before we move on, generally speaking, are the number of folks needing Medicaid in North Dakota staying flat about now, dropping a little bit or rising a little bit? Do you know?
Well, throughout the pandemic, it's really kind of hard to gauge it. You know, before it was pretty much flat. Now we've seen an increase, and that's because of the artificial inflation of our rolls because we had to ensure continuous eligibility. So we definitely expect to see, you know, as we start peeling people off of the rolls, it should get back to some sense of normal. I really think it's going to take another 6 months to a year to kind of figure out what our recalibrated Medicaid caseloads will look like.
Let's move on and talk about SHIP, Commissioner. It's an initiative from the Health and Human Services Department. The mnemonic is for the State Health Improvement Plan. It's now been launched. We're going to talk about a business plan here in just a minute. What's SHIP and what should North Dakotans know about it?
Absolutely. So SHIP is really an extension of our inaugural business plan. And what that really means, it is the external vehicle to our organization where community partners, constituents, providers, our tribes, where they can all play a role in helping to make North Dakota the healthiest state. When we look at health, it is not just the responsibility of the health department. It is a responsibility of everyone, from public institution, corrections. It really is a holistic approach. And so this SHIP really is the vehicle that reaches out to all of those partners of saying, here's our goal. Here's where we intend to go. Here's what health looks like. We need your help. We solicit your partnership. And I think it's an excellent, excellent vehicle for doing it. It's an innovative approach to bringing people into the vision of making North Dakota the healthiest state in the nation.
And the SHIP isn't something that has just appeared. There's been some work on this over the last several months and years.
Absolutely. This is a multi-year initiative. You know, I will tell you, I met with the team who was responsible for pulling this together, and they have done a phenomenal job at, you know, stakeholder engagement. I mean, they've engaged everybody from corrections, tribes, providers, teachers, public citizens, really to get input. Again, we're trying to capture every aspect of what health means to the state, and really engaging that, you know, that large constituency, it really gives us a picture of the diverse needs and what we need to do, the programs we need to develop, the policies that need to be implemented. And this is all from, you know, citizens and constituents feedback.
Your office now is about to launch its first ever Health and Human Services Business Plan, and it's expected to impact public health services in North Dakota, like you alluded to just a moment ago. What is that business plan?
This business plan really is our reintroduction back into the community as an integrated agency. You know, as you're aware, over a year and a half ago, we merged the legacy Department of Public Health, Department of Human Services into one, what some people will call a super agency. We are the largest state agency. And we don't take that lightly. We understand the weight of our existence and the weight of the things that we need to do. By way of this business plan, we are looking to reintroduce ourselves to the community. People need to know who we are. They need to know what we do. They need to know how we're going to do it. They need to know what that means for them. And this business plan is going to do that. We have over 150 projects and initiatives that are all geared towards our vision of making North Dakota the healthiest state, but really creating better outcomes for North Dakotans. So everything from customer engagement, everything from client education, everything from expanding access to care, everything from providing services to children, to eradicating chronic diseases. We're going to have initiatives in that plan that's going to lead towards that. And how the ship actually intersects with that, you know, we understand as an agency, we can't totally eradicate chronic disease. It takes effort. It takes personal effort. It takes provider effort. You know, it takes effort from the community at large. And so as one of our goals is to make sure that we're expanding access to services and supports, we're looking out to the community to see what role do they play in helping to effectuate our vision of making North Dakota the healthiest state in the nation.
We're enjoying our conversation with Commissioner Wayne Salter. He's the executive director of the Department of Health and Human Services, appointed by Governor Burgum in January of this year. As you refine your business plan prior to its launch, Commissioner, what have you learned about North Dakota's biggest challenges that lay ahead to make North Dakota either more healthy or the healthiest place in the country?
You know, I think it's a challenge that, you know, other states experience. It is really battling with resources, you know, and making sure that we are properly staffed and resources to meet the needs. You know, we want to make sure as a state that we have an adequate provider network, that we have good concrete services and supports that are responsive to the community needs. And so I think that's going to ever be a challenge to do that. But I also think with, you know, effectuating good community partnerships, good relationship with our provider community, that we can begin to knit that safety net together to make it a stronger, more cohesive model for North Dakota.
I think all departments of health across the country during COVID came across a little bit of hurdle relative to public trust. How will the Health and Human Services Department, I guess, work to either build the public trust that is there or maybe repair some public trust that has now come up in states and even here in North Dakota relative to the Department of Health?
You know, as the new commissioner, I always get to hear, you know, people reach out to me all the time and they are not shy with letting me know the challenges that they've had with the agency, you know, in the last couple of years. You know, and I realize that the success of our agency is directly linked to the well-being and the trust of the people we serve. And so there's a couple of things that we're doing. One of the things that I'm really sharing with our team is that we're Health and Human Services. We are in the people business. People are our priority. You know, one of the biggest ways to diminish trust is being called and not being able to adequately respond. And so a lot of our effort now is really focused on organizational alignment. And that really means we've integrated these two agencies together. There should be some better customer experiences and outcomes because we're now joined. And so we're now taking time to really do that. And, you know, some would say, you know, Commissioner Salter, you've been very aggressive since your appointment in January. And I would respond, the people that we serve have some very aggressive needs, and we have to be aggressive to be able to keep pace with their needs and respond adequately to really build that trust. One of the first initiatives that we did in February, approximately 30 days after the appointment, I released our strategic framework. And this is how we operate as an organization. This is how we do business. These are our milestones that we want to work towards. It really gave the organization a sense of oneness now that we are integrated, so everybody can march towards the same vision. You know, as we look at our resources, you know, again, trust comes by experience. If people have had not so good experiences with the agency, they're going to form an opinion. And so it's our role as a newly integrated agency to change that opinion. And the only way that we can change that opinion is to be proactive and to show up and adequately respond. So we're spending a lot of time looking at our resources. We're spending a lot of time looking at our skill sets. We're spending a lot of time looking at our technology to make sure that when North Dakotans who are in need call us, the agency that serves people, we can respond, and we can respond appropriately.
What are you doing relative to the accountability part of launching the business plan, launching the ship, so that North Dakotans will know you're doing what you said you would do, and here's how we can see that you're doing that?
Absolutely. Two of our guiding principles, one of it is open and transparent communication. You know, as a government agency, we have to be able to be open with our constituency, with our providers, with our stakeholders, with our legislative leadership. And that's something that we are definitely re-energizing within our organization. And the second thing, it really is that communication aspect. You know, people want to be engaged. The third thing is responsible stewardship. You know, we have over a $6 billion budget. And if you talk to any of my finance team, if you talk to my newly hired CFO, she will tell you that I've said if our budget is $6,332,092, we will be accountable for the 92 cents. That's responsible stewardship. That's what the public expects of us. And so really being able to be transparent, to show people what we're doing, how we're doing it, how much it costs, how well we're managing our resources, our finances, to me, that adds credibility to our organization. You know, some would say that's a huge budget. That's a very large budget. It's the largest state agency budget. But when you think about it, we have over 150 programs and services. It's a large agency with a large responsibility. And so we're setting protocols in place where we can do that. We're redefining our budgeting process. We're creating different reports, different accountability mechanisms. So at any given moment, if someone wants to know, Department of Health and Human Services, what are you doing here? We can transparently show them, this is what we're doing. This is how we're performing. You know, I think it's a change in the culture, but I think it's one that we've needed for some time. And I honestly think that it's going to be a refreshing change for our communities to understand that we now have a responsive, proactive agency who's open and transparent with what they're doing. And so you'll be able to clearly see our metrics, our key performance indicators.
Is this on a website then?
It will be posted. It eventually, once we release it, it will be posted on the website. We want to be able to clearly show This is our goal, these are our objectives, and this is how well we're doing it. And the reality is, you know, there may be times when we do not meet one of our anticipated goals, and that's fine. We're going to be clear and transparent to say we fell short here, but here's what we're doing to make sure that we don't fall short again. Along with the business plan, we are working on divisional dashboards where people can clearly see how we're performing. Again, we don't want anybody to assume. You know, one of the things I also tell our teams is in the lack of information, people create their own realities. And if you've ever been in a position of leadership, you can spend about 85 to 90% of your time fixing realities that aren't really realities when we could have just provided the information up front. And so you'll see clearly defined dashboards. You'll see reporting mechanisms through our business plan. And we're going to proactively pump out information. You know, when we do good, we want to be able to tell the public, this is what we've done. You know, when we don't do something good, we want to be able to tell the public, this is what didn't go well, but here is what your trusted agency is doing to rectify it. Here's what we're doing to fix it. So you can expect to see more engaged communication coming out from our agency.
Commissioner, as we wrap up our discussion today, one of the things I wonder about is next year and 3 years and 5 years from now, because we will have a new executive leader in the state of North Dakota. We'll have a new governor. How do we know then that this work will move forward despite or with the support of a new governor?
The work that we're doing, it really is, it's work that everybody can agree to. I don't know that it matters who will be in that chair. Everybody agrees that in our state, chronic disease is an issue. Everybody agrees that in our state that we need to be a healthier state. You know, everybody agrees in our state that we have issues. We have behavioral health issues, and we need to tackle those mental health crises. You know, and so a lot of our services and programs, they're set on a trajectory. It is an agreed upon strategy that these are things that we need. In our leadership now and what we're trying to do, we want to set it up for years to come. You know, it goes beyond just 2, 3, 4, 5 years. You know, things that we are doing today, we will see incremental results, but they will really see the full impacts 5, 10, 15 years from now when we can look at, you know, what we've done through our SHIP. We can look at what we've done through our initiatives, and we see the lifespans of North Dakotans increase. We see the occurrence of chronic diseases decrease. So, you know, I don't think it's really relative to whomever the executive leader is. I think whomever it is, we can all agree that these are important challenges to all of us as North Dakotans.
Lastly, Commissioner, are you fairly confident that those listeners who are now living in rural North Dakota, who today have very different access to health care than I do living near Fargo, that they'll have what they need to support their physical and mental health?
You know, that's one of our priorities, right, is really the expansion of services. And so we are really looking strategically at those rural communities and figuring out how can we further expand on telehealth? You know, how can we get more providers? You know, again, that's part of the SHIP plan as well, is to strengthen the workforce. You know, we have to be strategic as a state, and we have to be intentional as a state of making sure that we don't overlook those rural communities.
Wayne Salter, he's the executive director of the Department of Health and Human Services. Commissioner, thanks for joining us on Main Street.
Thank you for having me.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 11th. Leading up to the June 11th primary, we've been celebrating democracy in North Dakota history. Today we learn about Arthur G. Sorley of Grand Forks, who was endorsed by the Nonpartisan League to become governor in 1924. Sorley had become part of the discord being experienced by the Republican Party. The Bismarck Tribune noted that the Leaguers going to the upcoming county convention were instructed to use their influence to help Sorley win. Sorley did win the election, serving as the 14th governor of North Dakota, succeeding IVA Republican Governor R.A. Nestos. IVA stood for the Independent Voters Association. It had formed to counter the Nonpartisan League's socialist influence on the state's Republican Party. Sorley took office in January 1925 and was reelected in 1927, again with NPL backing. However, his second term was cut short when he died in 1928. While citizens of the state mourned his death, many words of tribute were spoken in his honor. Bertha Palmer, the superintendent of public instruction, said he was an indefatigable worker, but never too tired to give a smile and a pleasant word in greeting. State Treasurer C.A. Fisher said Sorley at all times worked for the interest of the people of North Dakota in an earnest and sincere way. George Schaefer, then Attorney General who would later become governor, said, "His death was, no doubt, hastened by the burdens and cares of his office, for he gave unreservedly of his strength and talents in the service of the state." Perhaps most remarkable was his open-door policy, which, by all accounts, he maintained to keep as close as possible to the people who elected him. A true servant leader, he wanted to meet with the people, no matter age or status. According to reports, he was especially popular with children and unfailing in kindness and courtesy. Teachers often conducted their classes through the Capitol building and visited the governor's office. It was a rare occasion when the executive did not find time to bid them welcome. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Sarah Walker. I'm Ann Alquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
And that's it For today's Main Street, we are grateful that you have spent time with us.
And tomorrow on the show, you get to meet Jessica Christie, the new executive director of the North Dakota Council on the Arts, as we hear about her plans for the organization and the time that she spent in the Chicago art scene. We're also going to have a preview of this weekend's 32nd annual Missouri River Bluegrass Festival at Cross Ranch State Park. And it is time for Prairie Plights with Rick Guion as he is talking sausage. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.